Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lauffel, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lauffel. And today, as every episode, we have a great guest. Of course, I'm talking about Brian Groft, who is a senior leader at SPA, or Systems Planning and Analysis, which is one of the firms in Washington that provides a lot of technical support to the Department of Defense and other agencies. And, you know, for those of you that don't know Brian, you know, he's a career Army FA-52 who's, you know, FA-52s are the Army's nuclear officers and support the CWMD mission. And of course, that means he's an engineer and scientist. And he spent lots of time at DITRA and USANCA, the Army's command for FA-52s in the nuclear force. And, you know, he spent his last handful of years at SPA helping to lead that organization. And today, so welcome to NucleCast, by the way, Brian. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be here. I love the ANWA Deterrence Center and all you guys do for promoting the nuclear enterprise.
Now, part of the reason that I asked you on the show was because we've never really had a discussion about the ANAS mission. And so for some of our listeners, they may be familiar with it, and they may have perhaps have heard that term in passing. And so since SPA is kind of one of those organizations in DC that provides a lot of support on technical expertise, to, you know, a variety of organizations, I thought who better to have on than Brian Groft to talk about that very mission. And so with that in mind, can you perhaps give us, you know, sort of a background of, I mean, what is ANAS? What does that term stand for? You know, what is that mission? How did it come about? And sort of what roles and functions do folks who do that mission, what do they do and what do they contribute to the nuclear enterprise?
Sure. No problem, Adam. Yes, I think that's it's apropos topic because right now, as DOGE continues to do its thing in the government and look for places to cut and so forth, sometimes the attention is drawn towards these type of contracts. And I think that, you know, with the background I've got and having been a supervisor of ANAS contractors and now have been on the other side providing those types of supports to the government, I think that's, you know, it's a good way to bring this up. And it's something that we don't often talk about. We hear a lot about other contractors, performers, M&A, and so on. And I think that you know, it's good to do. And just real quick, I mean, I'm a retired Army 52. I spent the latter part of my career doing that. You know, before I was a tanker, I was in the United States Army. I started out in with a mission in the Fulda Gap during the height of the evil empire days, part of what would have been a nuclear battlefield at that point. My battle position would have been a persistent chemical strike. I know that now. And that started my sequencing into that type of field. Eventually, I taught physics at West Point. And when you do that, you get recruited to be a 52. I went and did that. And then later in my career, after my stint on tanks in my 20th year, I became an Army 52. And then went to DTRA as the And that's where I actually ran into my first ANES contract, in that I was the chief LNO in what was the Combat Support Directorate, which had both what is now the nuclear enterprise and also everything that was ops in one place. And I had an ANES contractor supporting me as in the chief LNO office. And we had them basically all over the place. It was a more comprehensive look at that time. At that time, the agency, DTRA, used more comprehensive ANES contract, where those contractors supported across most of the agency. And NITRA is a thing in itself, and we could talk about that for maybe two sessions at some point. And then I went on from there to go to from there to go to USANCA eventually, and at USANCA stood up the Army's first field operating agency to address nuclear and counter WMD for the Army G-57. And after that, I became an ANES contractor and came to Northrop Grumman task at that point. And we had the large ANES contract on RD, what is now the Research and Development Enterprise, and also the nuclear enterprise. And I did that as the assistant PM, largely for Paul Peroni back in the day when NE was its own thing. Then we put it together with CS and made it ON, and then we broke it up again as DITRA reorganized many times. And so we were fundamental to delivering decision support to the agency at all levels and helping the PMs and TMs, the technical program managers and the PMs to execute their mission. I can go over now a little bit more about what makes ANES contracting therefore unique. As an example, at DITRA, typically you'll have an ANES staff, advisory and assistant services staff that is working alongside the government and providing them decision support to perform the daily functions, but in a way that includes, you know, cogent and direct decision support to help them to decide which contractors to pick, what missions to do, how to execute those missions, how to build the support that's necessary for the warfighter. As you know, DTRA is like the BASF of the warfighter in terms of dealing with counter WMD and nuclear issues. And so we comprehensively support that. The other thing that I should note is that it has its challenges. Basically, it was invented in the 1980s when the government got rid of many of their subject matter experts and then started to rely, needed contractors to come in and provide those things, but not at a as a personal service, but as an objective and independent, flexible and adaptable decision support apparatus. The government needs objective advice with answers it may not like, but it needs in order to tackle the tough problems. And so we deliver coherent, logical decision-making ability for the government. And we don't push solutions. We help the government attain its mission, goals, and objectives by giving them the right people, process, tools, in accordance with the guidance, to deliver decision aids and processes that make them successful in carrying out any particular mission they do to obtain their objectives. We staff what the mission needs, and while we coordinate hiring and staffing, we make the decisions, we get thanked later. I can tell you stories about times when we were hiring a person on staff to do the support that was necessary, and sometimes that was objected to even by the government. And the manager went forward, hired the person because they knew they were the right person for the job. And they were thanked later by hiring those people to deliver that support that was necessary for the government. We get paid to hire the right folks with the right skill set and the right attitudes to be flexible, reliable, trustworthy. But again, it's not staffing support or personal services. these folks perform mission and analyses that makes it possible for the government to carry its mission.
Now, before you go forward, can perhaps explain the differences between those three things? Personal support, staffing versus ANES. Well, you know, what are the three differences? And then, you know, secondly, you said independent analysis. And, you know, one of the things for me as somebody who's been, you know, both a civil servant for a couple of decades and then left government and moved to the other side of the table, you know, it seems that the government in many instances says, hey, listen, just do what we tell you. We don't really care what you think. Do what we say. So can you distinguish perhaps what you mean by independent analysis and, you know, that relationship and help our listeners to understand sort of the bounds of how things work?
Sure. Yeah, I think, I mean, basically, yes, you tell me what to do, Mr. Government, but I'm going to do it in a way that's, unbiased. I could say, you know, it's reliable, it's trustworthy, and I may give you an answer you don't want. I worked on analysis of alternatives before, in which we were part of a team that was working with other contractors from a particular agency to go unnamed in this podcast. And we knew that there was a bias from that particular agency to build structures and so forth to support some of the outcomes of the AOA. We knew that going in, and we protected our government PM that was working at DITRA at the time to make sure that, you know, he walked away with a solution that was, you know, again, objective and reliable and coherent and was not too influenced by the other agency.
Right. And then what's the difference between ANAS, personal support, you know, these three terms that you mentioned here?
Sure. I mean, sometimes you'll have contracts and they've had these at DTRA. I've watched them also when I was in a contractor at DHS, in which they have admin support services. In other words, those people are going to provide the staffing solution to do the admin there. And so they're going to be answering on a direct basis to put out memos and to record meetings and minutes and do things like that are more routine and less in the decision-making realm. The other kind of contractor you typically have at DITRA, like RD, the Research and Development Directorate, is they have a counter WMD IDIQ, which we call the performers. And so those folks, you know, I look at them, they're the metal benders. They provide solutions, whether it be software or hardware or some type of combination of software service solution that the government needs. But it's our task to make sure that those things are delivered the right way for the mission. And while the performer does that, they do it in a different basis. And the government hires them based on recommendations we make as unbiased, advisors for the government.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. So I interrupted you. You were sort of laying this out for me.
Well, and the other thing that people may not understand too is that while we involve the government, inform the government on people we're hiring, what the qualifications are and so forth, we make those decisions independently because we understand the mission we're trying to deliver and we're being held accountable for total mission accomplishment. Both for supporting a particular office within the directorate and so forth. But we don't look at it that contractor is a servant of a particular PM. He's there to attain the mission that the PM has, and we're to be there to deliver on that and give the decision support necessary for them to maintain that function within the agency.
Now, can ANAS folks, can they make decisions for the government?
Oh, yeah.
How does that work?
Roger, we can't inherently governmental functions we cannot perform. We can do all kinds of support up to a point. We can attend meetings and so forth, but we do not make decisions for the government whatsoever. You know, if we did that, I mean, we would be violating the FAR, the federal regulations governing contracting, and we'd also be biased in terms of how we are performing with these other contractors that government has contracted for specific delivery of products or services.
And can you help, you know, because one of the things that for me is somebody who's been on both sides, you know, when you're sitting on the government side, you often look over and you look at a contract and you say, gosh, those guys are so expensive. Can you maybe help folks understand the reality of, you know, the cost of, you know, contractors and whether they are or are not more expensive than civil servants?
On the whole, we're less expensive. And the way that happens is that when you're a government person, has to be supported by an apparatus, and they have to have certain things that the government has, which are the benefits that the government employees have and their retirement and those types of things cost a lot of money for the taxpayer. And so while we have an overhead as a contractor and we have a salary and overhead, and that all goes into our price that we charge, the government knows exactly what they're buying. They know by hour how much this person costs and that person. They know on the whole, they know monthly what they're being charged for those services, and it's very easy to keep track of. On the other hand, I mean, in the government, we know salaries of folks all the time. I used to give bonuses based on, you know, certain aspects of performance for them, but I can tell you that it's more costly. And I'll summarize it this way. When I became a contractor in 2009, the Army had gone through, and all the services really did, and going through a time of insourcing. They were taking the dollars away from the contracting they did, and they were hiring government folks to come in and do the work. There's two problems with that. One is it's very expensive. So the Secretary of the Army made a decree, I think it was in 2009, and said, we're not doing this anymore. There's no more insourcing. We are going to, you know, more heavily rely on contractors. The other thing that you get when you hire us is you can change your mind. If the mission changes, if your priorities change, if the way you're going to attain your objectives, if the technologies are different that we need to have in the next contract year than we had on this, you can change your mind and redirect how we're performing the mission, and we will adjust that completely. And, you know, it's one of the hardships of being a contractor sometimes when those things happen. You know, you have to either find a job, or we in the company work very hard to find you other work that's appropriate.
Yeah.
But we're flexible.
Yeah, it's always, you know, I remember as a government civil servant thinking, man, these guys have awfully high rates. But what I'd never thought about was, you know, what does it cost the government for my benefits? What does it cost the government for the office that I sit in? You know, the electricity, the air conditioning, the maintenance of the building. What is the cost of HR for me and the other civil servants? And that's oftentimes one of the things that I think gets overlooked for civil servants, is they compare themselves and their what they think of as just their salary to the actual cost of, you know, of a contractor, where they can see how all of that is built in to the cost of, you know, that individual, that FTE. It's laid out there, you know, in black and white. So, you know, I think that's sort of one of the things that's important to keep in mind. Now, the other topic that we wanted to discuss, you know, beyond, you know, what is ANAS and what does it mean and why do we do it, is, you know, the future of DTRA, it seems it's very uncertain right now. There's a lot of discussion about should Ditcher go away? Should it be reorganized? What exactly should it look like? And for you, and for those that may not know, Army FA-52s are, you know, nuclear officers for the Army. They very frequently spend a very good portion of their careers in DITRA. It's one of sort of the one of the main places they often go, because the Defense Threat Reduction Agency is a combat support agency that provides all kinds of useful things to warfighters. So, you know, for the folks at STRATCOM, your targeting software, well, that's designed by DITRA. You know, a lot of the inputs that go into that kind of software comes, you know, might come from DIA, but it's integrated through DITRA. And there's a lot of other non-proliferation efforts and all sorts of things that DITRA does. And so for those who are not exactly familiar with DITRA and what it performs, can you maybe give a quick overview of sort of what DITRA does? And then, you know, how would you see, you know, DITRA's role in the future if you had, you know, the magic wand and could make DITRA be the most efficient, most effective agency that it could possibly be?
Sure. I think that I would just say that DITRA does a full gambit of proliferation, non-proliferation, counter WMD, nuclear integration, nuclear surety support, and so on across the spectrum of, if you call it nuclear and counter WMD, you know, for the DOD. And in doing so, they perform, you know, there's the R&D directorate that provides research and development support for the whole mission for the DOD. And that goes from counter weapons of mass destruction technologies, like in the, and I can talk a little bit more about the Fordo mission that was recently conducted against Iran. I mean, when you think about the things that DITRA delivers, there was a lot of operations / integration and technical support that's delivered for that, in addition to just the implementation of technologies. And so DITRA does a great job of doing that. And of course, the chairman, you know, greatly appreciated, you know, DITRA's work and that mission and that's been going on for quite some time. That's the other thing that people don't always remember, is these types of technical challenges that DITRA takes on may take decades to build the technologies, the manpower in terms of the expertise needed, and to implement those types of things and help the services integrate the missions. I think that that's critical, and DITRA does that as a combat support function, but also in terms of their R&D support like a DOD R&D agency. So RD does that. They support the nuclear enterprise, as you were saying. They build the tools and models that STRATCOM uses, and how they integrate those things in a coherent fashion to address targeting and weapons and so forth. And supporting the stockpile, looking at nuclear survivability of all these aspects of not just the nuclear enterprise, but also the DOD systems that are out there, and carrying out things like DODI 315009 functions and so forth that are critical to mission support if we get involved in a nuclear conflict that's going to obviously also employ, you know, conventional systems in conventional warfare. The other thing that DITRA does is supports the chem biodefense enterprise through CB at RD to do those types of technologies, whether they be detection or protection or you know, survivability issues with regards to that, prophylactic, supporting the enterprise in terms of the chem biodefense. That's a huge part of the budget and what they do. And it's a mission that continues this pretty robustly even today, while other things are getting downsized. Then they also support the nuclear enterprise. Of course, NE does that through a whole bunch of programs going all the way from nuclear surety, nuclear security, into areas like mission assurance, that while it involves the nuclear enterprise, it does a lot also for in the combat support functions for commands and headquarters that are out there for its command and control and C4ISR missions. In addition to that, we have non-proliferation programs that help with either security cooperation side, but also with the threat reduction side. And so there's a lot of work they do there. DTRA does a good function on a combat support side in the new CZ directorate. And that mission has changed over time, but on a daily basis, DTRA supports worldwide operations that involve counter-WMD operations and so forth. A lot of that is classified, but some is not. And the planning functions that have to go on, the training functions that have to go on, and those types of things, in addition to exercises on a daily basis. One of the key missions that DTRA does that I'll, you know, because I started it as a program, I didn't invent it, which is DTRA Reachback. DTRA Reachback is a performs a huge function worldwide on a daily basis, hourly, supporting headquarters and various functions in order to understand how, you know, weapons of mass destruction, how chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and explosive items interact and do modeling and simulation and decision support for everybody from first responders to commands. And so that's a huge mission too. So DTRA has an important mission, but I'll plug this. I'll give an example of why DTRA is needed and why ANES contracting is needed even more today. And in the new JSIDS free environment, ANES contracting staff can help the government, you know, quantify requirements systematically and attain the right technology and system for the warfighter. Because I think you're going to need a lot of good decision support that's much more rapid, much more flexible. And we can do that today with the technologies that we implement to help people make those decisions. And I think that obviously that's what Secretary Hegseth was doing when he eliminated the JSIDS process, which was pretty onerous and slow. So I think that's a place where DTRA can help out. And also, you know, ANES contracting can help DTRA as it moves through, whether it be research and development or also transition or also acquisition systems.
Join the ANWA Deterrent Center in NucleCast at the annual Nuclear Deterrence Summit, January 26th through 28th at the Crystal Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. This premier event brings together decision makers from government, national laboratories, and industry for strategic updates, high-value networking, and practical conversations that drive partnerships and business. Sign up through the link on our website to receive a 15% discount at anwadeter.org. We hope to see you there.
So it's that time in the show where I'll have to bring out Bob the Genie. And so as I rub my
already?
Magic lamp,
oh my gosh.
So as I rub my magic lamp, you know, as you know, Bob grants all guests three wishes related to the topics of discussion. So with that in mind, Brian, what is your first wish?
Well, I think that I'd like to see DTRA, you know, fulfill that combat service agency role to do, you know, a better job of bringing industry and government together to solve some of these problems. I think that in the area of perhaps developing, I think you had a show just recently on looking at road mobile ICBM. And I know, you know, Bob Peters and others are big proponents of it. And I think that it's something that really needs to be looked at. Well, DTRA would be the perfect place to do the analysis of the logistics and the regulatory aspects, the mission accomplishment, effectiveness, and so forth, and to put together basically an AOA for that type of system or systems and look at different alternatives in an objective way, whereas the Air Force has its own biases as a service. The DoD is a very complicated place. I think DITRA could blow into that with good authority and do the right type of analysis objectively to do that.
Yeah, that's a good point. So that's wish number one. How about wish number two?
Carrying it further, I think that DITRA could get more involved in, I would call it conventional nuclear integration, but I'll give a little bit of background. I think with the rise of theater nuclear weapons, a lot of concern in that area, I think DITRA could be very important in working with agencies like USANCA to deliver, again, back to objective, unbiased look at what needs to be done and what's the future look like. Develop the CONOPS, the CONEMPS, and the force structure that we need to go for the future. I think DITRA could do a great job in that area moving forward.
All right.
And in fact, do I have time to talk about how DITRA developed? I wish we had time, but we could, maybe it's another broadcast, but they could, DITRA actually worked when they were DNA, worked with the Army and the Air Force to eventually deliver what became Airland Battle back in the 1980s. But that started in the 70s, and it started because of nuclear weapons and theater nuclear weapon employment in Europe.
Huh. Well, that's okay. That's an interesting teaser. We'll have to do that.
Right.
So wish number three, your final wish. So you got to make it a good one.
Right. I think DITRA could probably do a little bit better in communicating, in a sense, with industry. They do a great job, and they go out of the way to do it. But I think everybody, not just DITRA, but all the agencies that I see, needs to really step up and to team with industry so we can work together to build solutions that are better going forward. We're going to have to do it more rapidly now. There's a lot of antiquated things that have gone on. I mean, we were tied up in the Middle East in a war, you know, the counter IED conflict for far too long that distracted us. And I think it's time to get back to war making. And I think in doing so, again, with the theater nuclear, whether it's the theater nuclear problem or whatever it is, I think DITRA could work with industry and actively seek solutions, working with industry on a daily basis and sharing ideas and not being afraid of taking risk. Oh, we might get a protest if we talk too much to industry. No, you can do it in a way that does not. And I think that, you know, I think going forward, I'd like to see the cooperation step up between contractors and government to deliver those solutions.
So as we end the show and you have, you know, that sort of mic drop moment where you walk off the stage, what's that final thought you want our listeners to understand about both, you know, the ANAS workforce and DITRA?
Yeah, well, I think going forward, I think they can use us more and more better in ways that will help innovate. And one of the things that I think we can see is more, you know, develop more structures so we can build eclectic teams that come together. And I think I've done this myself. We've done it on our current contract in RD, and I've seen it as a history at SPA, which is you can put together analysts and scientists and engineers and senior advisors in what I call eclectic teams to give you a solution that's better than you would get if you hired a few, you know, high-powered brains. And I think that's going forward. I think we need more of that type of teamwork to deliver these types of decision solutions for the government that are actually better and address the problem in more comprehensive and coherent fashion.
All right, Brian Groft. Thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Sure. Thanks, Adam. Thanks for having me. And like I say, there's lots of stories to discuss with this, the new problems that we have in the new world.
And of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of NucleCast. And we'll see you next time.
This has been a production of the NY Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NuclearCast.